We are in the middle of Perek Daled, chapter 4, with a goal this week of getting through the rest of chapter 4 and chapter 5. We are ambitious. We can do it, I think. If you're using the stone Tanakh, you want to look at page 1624. We began last time by noting the difficulties involved in trying to identify a unique voice for each of the people who visit Iyov, who visit Job. And we talked about some of the challenges involved, and then we introduced Eliphaz, who is the first of the three. He is the greatest of the three. He speaks first, he speaks the longest, he has great poetic style, he presents visions, which we saw a little bit about last week. He is a believer in divine justice. He believes that doing good deeds doesn't mean that you've never sinned and doesn't mean that you will be spared from punishment. And he evolves in his view of Job, although we don't yet know what's going to stimulate this evolution. But in his first appearance, chapters 4 and 5, he believes Job is good and just needs to turn to God. Later he will become more indignant, and finally he will say, "We know you have sinned, Job, the game is over." Why he evolves again, we still need to find out. We noted that quite a bit, or at least some of what Eliphaz says, actually makes it into our liturgy. And we also noted that the Talmud criticizes Eliphaz, and it believes that he is guilty of ona'at devarim, verbal abuse, for his statements to Job when he says that if you were truly innocent, this wouldn't be happening to you, more or less, as the Talmud understands it. So we began with verses 1 to 6 in chapter 4, in which Eliphaz requested permission to speak. He offers an apology, but he says, "I must." And then he began his actual comments with sentences 7 to 11, in which he said, "Wicked people suffer." Is this still on?
Yeah.
It is on. Okay, good. He said, "Wicked people will suffer." He used the word Aleph Bet Dalet, right? La'avod, la'abed. It's used in various forms, a term used for destruction. And he says, "Wicked people suffer and are destroyed. Good people are not destroyed." Whether that means they suffer, but they're not destroyed entirely, or it means they won't suffer at all, depends on how you read it. But he says, the wicked are the ones who suffer. And then the last bit that we saw, sentences 12 to 16, he humbly introduced a vision. He said, "I have something special to tell you. It was stolen to me. I wasn't worthy, and yet I was able to perceive at this time of dreams and the darkness and the night, I was able to perceive something, and now I am coming to you to convey my vision to you." And that's what we're about to read. So it's chapter 4, sentence 17, in the stone Tanakh. Once again, you are on page 1624. In other Tanakhs, you are on other pages. I heard a 1664 down there. 1662. Okay. So if you take a look at sentence 17, you find him reporting what his vision is. And he says something which is going to require, surprise, some explanation. Ha'enosh me'eloka yitzdak. There are a lot of ways you could translate those very charged words. Curious. Art Scroll translates it as, "Can a mortal man be more righteous than God?" They take the mem, me eloka, meaning more than, above. But there are other ways you could take it. Among the other Tanakhs in use around the table, are there other translations besides this one, besides "Can a mortal man be more righteous than God?"
Shall mortal man be just before God?
Ah, not the word just isn't the catch. Shall a mortal man be just before God, meaning in front of God? Okay. What do you have? You have the same edition. Okay.
Shall mortal man be more just than God?
So that's also taking the more righteous. It's just a question of whether you translate Yitzdak as righteous or just, which you can play with either way. Yeah.
And that is be acquitted by God.
Be acquitted by God. A whole different take. All of this depends on what you do with the letter mem. that one prefix, because it's such a malleable prefix, that you could legitimately take any of these translations as the meaning of the words. It is true that people normally translate it as the Ark Scroll does, saying, can a man be more righteous than God? The problem with it, with taking that translation, is number one, how does that exactly fit the whole theme? Job never claimed to be more righteous. Unless you're going to say Job is accusing God of being unjust, and therefore claiming, I have a better sense of righteousness than God does. You know what the problem is with that read? It's a very important problem. Has Job actually said anything about God yet?
No.
Not a thing. So what would Eliphaz be responding to? Nothing. So that's why that read is a difficult read. It seems to come out of nowhere. And so some struggle to provide other explanations, particularly because the mem lends itself to that. Yes?
But Job doesn't feel that he deserves what happened to him, even though he's not blaming God.
Has Job said he doesn't deserve it? So far? All we have of Job is Job saying, boy, I wish I had never been born, or I wish I wasn't still alive, or I wish the universe didn't exist. What is happening to me is terrible. We have not yet seen him say anything about God. This is a focal point, because I think a lot of the commentaries miss this. Job hasn't done that yet. Alina? He did? How did he? Right, in his initial point, he recognized God forgiving. That's absolutely true, and he justified God taking away. But when he turned angry, he didn't mention God at all. Yes?
But he isn't blaming anybody, is he?
He isn't blaming anybody.
What?
No, there's been no blame. There's been no blame. Right.
He's not blaming anybody for it at the moment.
So one problem... Right, that's true. He hasn't blamed. So one problem that we have here is, what does the sentence mean if you're saying, can he be more righteous than God? It had nothing to do with what Job had said. It's not a response. Which, you know, we've already noted. Malvim said no one seems to be answering each other anyway in this book. So they're just all, you know, saying what's on their mind.
So
this is the most realistic book in Tanakh.
Why is this being asked?
Right. And then another question is, I mean, I understand there's such a thing as a rhetorical question.
Yeah.
But, like, you know what the answer is, right? Our definition of God, and the working definition in Tanakh, includes being who is more righteous than everybody else. So, are you asking this just to make Job say no? Like, why are you asking this question of Job, Diana?
I think we mentioned last week that it seems in what he's saying that he knows something about Eeyore that we have not gotten in the picture. So he's responding to Eeyore's character that he, as a friend of Eeyore's, knows about, that we didn't get that information. So maybe Eeyore was that kind of person. We got some hints of it in the first parak about him bringing the sacrifices for his children and whatever. It's kind of a, you know, like, where does he come off doing that? So maybe he does have that kind of holier than thou attitude.
But this isn't about, you mean, you know, you claim to be holier than thou in your service of God. So it's a response not to what Job had said in the previous chapter, but it's a more general comment to Job about his character.
Yeah.
It seems like an odd time to throw that in.
Yeah.
Well,
it's also odd because, keep in mind, he claims this was a vision he had. Whether it is or not. Right, if he's really reporting a vision as opposed to just putting it in that type of a framework. Yes?
Or else he's just building an argument here. This is the platform. We're going to start here and then something's going to come next. Not so much as a response, but I'm about to say something, so here we go.
Right, and it definitely fits into the next verses, so that could be a take. Let's go through the vision. It's just the rest of this chapter here, 17 to 21, and then I want to come back to this and show you what I found to be a brilliant insight into this. Pasuk Yudchet, sentence 18. He says, "Hein ba'avadav lo ya'amin, u'malachav yasim tahala." He says, God doesn't even trust his servants. Now, servants could mean anything, but the second half of the sentence explains who we mean. Uv'malachav, in his malachim, his angels, yasim tahala, he says, they have tahala. Tahala is understood to be some form of disgrace. He looks at them and finds them to be inadequate. Like the term holalut is a potentially related word, which is really mockery. But even the angels don't live up to God's expectations. So how could you think that you are righteous in the eyes of God, if I take that as my translation, right? Or more righteous than God? Even the malach, which is separate from this plane, which is not physical and not subject to the weaknesses of flesh, even the malach can't live up to God's expectations. So, who do you think you are? Keep reading though, we're not done. Af shochnei batei chomer, asher be'afar yisodam, yidak'um lifnei ash. So he says, people too, shochnei batei chomer, which is a lovely evocative phrase, right? Shochnei batei chomer, those who dwell in houses of clay. Right? Is that, I assume that's the translation. Something like that. So he says, if the malachim can't meet God's expectations, then certainly those who dwell in houses of clay, whose foundation is in the earth, yidak'um, he will wear them out, lay them low, lifnei ash, before the worm. Yeah, this isn't a happy book, I'm sorry. Ash often is a moth. Ash often is a moth. But it's understood here that we're talking about something associated with the decay of a body, and that's why I went with worm. But yes, ash often is a moth. Miboker la'erev yukatu. From morning to evening, they are struck down. Mibli meisim lanetzach yovedu. Without anybody even paying attention, they perish lanetzach, forever. What forever is going to mean to Eliphaz, we'll have to see in chapter 5, but that's what he says. Halo nisa yisram, actually it's later than that. Halo nisa yisram bam yamusu velo bechochma. The word yitram or yisram that he uses here is a hard word. I believe it's understood to be either the string of a bow or the rope that holds a tent. Taut. Either way, it's supposed to be a taut rope of some kind. So, halo nisa. Nisa means made to move, made to be moved. It has been shifted. Their yeter, their rope that's holding up their tent, so to speak, is shifted askew. Yamusu, they die. Velo bechokhma, and they die without wisdom. So number one, they're very fragile. And number two, they are foolish. That's what he's saying is the salient points about the human being that you need to know. And this is the vision that has come to him. He has great imagery. This man has a house or a tent that collapses easily. The whole thing with the clay and the dirt is great reading.
The human body.
Yeah. House. Precisely.
Who is it that's speaking here?
This is whatever angel gave him a vision.
So could it be Satan?
Oh, that's an interesting question. When he says, some words came to me, maybe it came from the Satan? That's interesting. I had always assumed Satan was done. He had exited a stage left, and now the friends are doing his work. Part of the question has to be, is this really a vision at all, or is this just his way of articulating his message? So I think we need to answer that question too. I can't answer that question, so I can't answer this one.
It says that malachim are not perfect, so they must have a nasty purpose here.
Well, not necessarily. Satan is just as perfect as any other malach. He just happens to have a mission that we don't like. That doesn't, you know, the person whose job it is to do bad things may be very good at his job. Yes.
Aren't these friends, three or four friends, however many they are, aren't they elements of Satan? It is not an angel, a conduit between God and man, so they are satanic angels. Like,
yes.
Seems clear.
Yeah.
I'm sure it is.
No, nothing about this book. There is not a single sentence in this book in which you could say, this is what the book says, and let's move on to the next verse. It doesn't work that way. But we did say, when we prefaced the whole section about them, that one solid way to look at them, and I think Da'at Mikra is of this view, Amos Chacham is of this view, is that they are his next test. his wife was also one of them. And insofar as we take the concept of Malach as any being that serves the divine plan, then yeah, they are indeed, in that sense, Malachim. However, I don't know that Eliphaz, you know, is thinking that. I mean, keep in mind, we still haven't decided whether he lived. But if he lived, I don't know if that's what he is thinking about himself. I imagine he would not be thinking this about himself. Here I am serving a demonic purpose by going to visit my friend and tell him nasty things.
Yeah, but he is an angel, small a, angel of Satan, then he's a convert.
But not...
He's like the devil's advocate.
Yeah, well, I see...
Except that no one's prosecuting the devil here. Right? The devil's advocate requires that
This is way too complicated.
Well, it doesn't have to be that intricate. I think your point is well taken. I think the point you're making is that they are not bringing Job closer to any sort of consolation or comfort. And we will see that. They're going to drive him further from it, and we're going to see that as well. Leave aside Satan. I'm done with him. We talked about him already. Yes.
Who translated it as tentacle?
Yeah, what do they say?
Our scroll based on Russian says, "Behold the pride within the hearts." And I'm in Russian, get pride out.
That's interesting. Okay, well, the way he got it would be to take Yud Tav Resh, instead of taking it the way I did as connected to Meitarim, which are these ropes and poles that hold things taut, he's taking it as Yoter, which means greater than. So their pride, which is elevated within them, that's the way he's taking it. Okay. Don't be surprised. When I went through this to prepare this, I saw many views that I had to just discard in the interest of trying to present something coherent. So yeah, you'll find things like that. Sharon.
When Job made a statement, he admitted that you could come into this room with nothing and you leave with nothing, talking about possessions.
What do you mean? You mean because it says in the end, Yamutu v'lo b'chokhma? Right. Right. Well, Eliphaz, what Sharon pointed out, is that we talked about possessions earlier, entering the world without possessions, leaving the world without possessions, and here he's talking about dying without wisdom. But I think the two passages reflected two different messages. The earlier passage was Job, who had lost his possessions, saying, oh well, you enter the world without possessions, you leave without possessions. It was God's ability to do that because they're not mine, they're not connected to me, and so on and so forth. Here, what Eliphaz is trying to do is to take away Job's self-confidence. Not self-confidence, that's not the right word. What he perceives to be Job's arrogance. He believes that Job has judged what is going on in his life and found it to be unjust. He believes that Job, therefore, is declaring God to be unjust, even though Job hasn't said that. And therefore, he's saying, you're a human being. Number one, you're puny and frail. You break easily. After this, for sure. But number two, he's saying, you're not wise. Human beings live their whole lives and don't acquire wisdom. So how can you think that you can judge what's going on in this world and decide what's good and what's bad? I think that's why he focuses on... And by the way, he's not done. The chapter is over, but he owns chapter 5 also. So we have more to see about what he's going to say. But I wanted to... Having now seen this vision... Yeah, Ralph?
He's not very courageous. Why doesn't he just come out and say it? And instead of putting it in some amorphous words...
What would you like to hear him say?
He can say just what he feels.
What? Which is...
Which is just what you said, that these things don't happen just like that.
Oh, he did that too, though. He did that also, right? Go back to sentence 7. But he didn't pay by the word. In sentence 7, he said, remember now who is lost or who is destroyed, who is innocent. He's already made his point in that regard. He is adding here. He's not simply waxing poetic. He's developing new ideas, which once we've seen the text, we'll be able to appreciate. He's developing more than what he said back there. But yes, this is the style we are meant to associate with Eliphaz. When you're a writer and you put multiple characters in a book, you have to be very careful that they don't all sound like the author. right? You give each of them a distinctive voice. It's debatable whether the three friends are actually going to have distinctive voices. It's hard for us to tell, especially because Hebrew is not, generally speaking, and this style of Hebrew certainly is not our first language. So being sensitive to the nuances is tricky. Catching which words get repeated by which people is a hard thing to do. But one of the characteristics of Eliphaz is this flowery poetry. Susan?
Is part of this teaching us, part of that, everybody always talks you sound like one of Job's heifers. I'm not talking about women, that term. Job's heifers is very common about a not very good, person who's not doing a very good job of being a friend or whatever. If this is a parable and it's out to teach us, we have three people who, God forbid, I would not have thought of in my inner circle, so to speak. What kind of friends are they? Is part of that parable to show us about people's, what is good in people's relationship, bad or whatever?
So, I would say two things. Number one, I would say that yes, that is a lesson that very clearly emerges, and that was that passage I brought last week from the Talmud that said he's guilty of verbal abuse, which is biblically prohibited. So that's, they're drawing that lesson. The second point I would make is that it's very hard to know what the intent was. Meaning, the Anshei Knesset HaGedolah is the group that canonizes Tanakh. They're the ones who look at this text and say, this belongs in sacred scripture that we're going to now pass down for the Jews. What motivated them is hard to say. What did they see here and say, this is why it should be in, is very hard to say. I don't know. Dahlia?
Oh, I just wanted to say that in this Sansino edition, they quote Baba Metzia, the
Yep, that was last week. That was the one about the verbal abuse, right?
Right, and but it sort of echoes what she just said, in that in the Talmud it says if one is visited, you think you're suffering.
Yeah.
If one is visited, this is exactly what not to say.
Yeah, no, that's
so
exactly
that,
it.
Basically, the Gemara would agree with her.
Yeah.
That's the lesson to be learned.
Right, no, that was it. That was, on last week's worksheet. The I want to go back to the beginning of his comments here. Sentence 17. I want to go back to this question. Can one be more righteous than God? So maybe it's a rhetorical statement, but take a look at source number one on your sheets. Richard Whitekettle, Journal of Biblical Literature, 2010. He says, scholars have found... I love when you say that. You don't have to tell them who they are. Scholars have found... It's like when you say, the sages say. Scholars have found... Yeah. Scholars have found that one rhetorical function of a hyperbole or overstatement is to elicit a corrective response from an audience. That is, a person who recognizes something as an overstatement will mentally correct the overstated idea down to the proper level. If a speaker speaks to a crowd and says something that is clearly over the top, hopefully the intelligent listener is going to, in their own mind, think to themselves, he's gone too far, and turn it back to where it really belongs, what actually makes sense. Neither Job nor Eliphaz believed that a human being could be more righteous than God. Thus, when Job was asked whether this was possible, in our sentence, Ano Shmei Elokai Yitzdak, he would have recognized that it was a hyperbolic impossibility. He would therefore have responded by making the following downward correction in his mind. No, a human being cannot be more righteous than God. A human being's level of righteousness is not that high. Having been compelled by the greater than rhetorical question to move a human being in a downward direction on a scale of righteousness, Job would have been primed to continue this downward trend via the graded series of items in sentences 18-19, which is to say, the malachim, the angels. And he's now not going to just say, well, we're not as high as God. We're not as high as the Malach either. In the course of that series, Job was led to see that in Eliphaz's thinking, at least, a human being belonged down past God, down past the angels, at a level of righteousness that was dramatically described as being amid the dust and moths. You follow what Whitekettle is doing? I think it's brilliant. By wording this question in this way, effectively what he's doing is he's turning to Job and saying, you think you're greater than God. In order for Job to mentally respond, no, of course not, that's ridiculous. Oh, I'm not greater than God, so who am I to now start challenging God? That's the way White Kettle looks at this. I thought that was a very keen insight on this. Even though there are other ways to read this. So the sum of this vision is, man is feeble, man is frail, man is relatively unrighteous. And all the women note, this is not just talking about men. The continuation of this in chapter 5 is for him to focus now on what Job is doing, what Job's response is. Chapter 5, sentences 1 to 7. Look at this. He says, Karana, go ahead, call out. Hayesha Mecca, is anyone going to answer you? Meaning anyone up there in heaven about to respond to your objections? Velmi mikadoshim tifnet, to which of the malachim, the holy ones, will you turn? Kila evil yaharag kas. He says a fool is killed by anger. Ufote. No, the samach and the sin interchange quite a bit. You find it with the word litfos also, to grab something. You find it with sota. You find it in a few cases, the samach and the sin. A fool is killed by anger. Ufote tamit kin'ah. Pote, or peti, is another term for someone who is foolish, is killed by outrage. I don't translate kin'ah as jealousy, because I believe that it's an incorrect translation. Kin'ah sometimes is jealousy. But generally speaking, kin'ah is outrage. When a person is indignant about something, feeling something is unjust and is wrong, sometimes it's so-and-so has something, I want it, and therefore I'm outraged with a jealousy motion, but it doesn't have to be so. So he says to Job, who has not been talking about jealousy at all, but outrage he's got plenty of. So he says, you know, a fool is killed by anger. A fool is killed by outrage. This one you could translate in a couple of different ways as well. I saw a fool. He's gone back to Evil for the fool. I saw a fool strike roots, meaning become successful. This clause you can translate as, I cursed his dwelling suddenly, or that the other way to say it is, I predicted that bad things would happen to his dwelling suddenly. In other words, not that I cursed it, because that's inconsistent with the character of Eliphaz, but I predicted that bad things were going to happen, and we'll see what happens. Yirchaku banav miyesha, his children are distanced from rescue, from salvation. V'idak'u bashar, they are crushed at the gate, they are laid low at the gate, v'ein matzil, and no one saves them. Asher kitziro ra'ev yochel, his harvest is eaten by somebody who's hungry. Ve'al mitzinim yikacheyu, they put it into baskets. V'sho'ach tzamim chelam, and their strength or their wealth is swallowed up by tzamim, which I've seen commentaries associate with tzimeim, those who are thirsty. Those who are thirsty will swallow up their wealth. So the fool I saw was successful, and then everything collapsed. Ki lo yitzei me'afar aven, u'mei adama lo yitzmach amal, ki adam lo amal yulad, u'bnei reshef, yagbihu uf. He adds two sentences to his thought, and he says, Adam, he says, lo yitzei me'afar aven, the corruption does not come out of the dirt. The suffering that one has does not come up out of the ground. The fact that you struggle is not the fault of the land. It's not the fault of the earth. Adam l'amal yulad. That's part of being a human being. Ubnei reshef yagbihu uf. And that is the hardest clause in this segment to translate. I'm going to render bnei reshef right now as sparks of flame, although we will see other explanations. Right. B'shefer rishpei eish al hevet. Yeah, exactly. So, Ubnei Reshef and the sons of the flame, the sparks, will fly upward. And within this reed, what he's saying is, people have to struggle just like flames have to float up in the air. It's inherent in your nature. Don't blame the universe for the fact that you're struggling. That's life. That's the comfort we're getting here. Boy, is he...
It sounds so much like
Kohala. Yes, to a certain extent, yes. Kohala is less cruel, I feel. But that's because there's no target in Kohala. Here there's a human target who's suffering. So that's this section, which I would summarize as saying, outrage is self-defeating. Right? Except that suffering is natural. This is the way it goes. He began by asking, what's the point of all this noise? Now, he does believe, as he's about to say, that God answers when people call them. He absolutely believes that. But not when you call out this way, cursing your birth. That's not the way to go about it. Along the same lines, if you take a look on your sheet, at source number 2, Commentary of Malbim. After he told Job the answer he had received in his prophecy, Amari love, he said to him, he says, lest Job be surprised, hey, why did the Malach come to Eliphaz in order to communicate this to me? Why didn't he tell it to me directly? So he explains, since you were foolish, you doubted that God is supervising anything. And this is again taking the view that that's what Job has done, even though God wasn't mentioned. Right? This is taking the view that when Job curses the stars and so on, he's saying the constellations caused this to happen to me. Well, what do you want then? You expect God to listen to you, even as you are declaring that God doesn't play a part. And God says, look, okay, you don't think I'm involved. I guess I won't be involved. Have it your way. That's the way that Malbim understands what he's saying here in the beginning. That this message came to me to give you because of all the noise that you're making. And frankly, outrage is bad for you. Now, he's not talking blood pressure. He could be, but he's not. Rather, a couple of different explanations of what he's trying to say here. If you take a look at source number 3, Ralbag. Ralbag, as always, is practical. He says, "Who, meaning the fool, who ha'ish asher yechaven pe'ulotav tachlit ma?" He says, the fool we're describing here is the type of fool who actually establishes a goal for his actions. But he doesn't actually calculate the proper way to achieve his goal. I want to be X. I want to be a basketball player. Oh, so what are you going to do? I don't know, I'll watch NBA on television. Right? So if you don't take proper steps, it's not going to happen. So that's the fool we're describing here. But how does he respond when his steps don't work? He gets frustrated, and therefore he is angry. But then the result is he just doesn't take proper steps. He doesn't do what he needs to do. He hasn't actually gained anything. A person who has wisdom is going to learn from his experiences. The person who is foolish is going to keep on banging his head against the wall and wondering why he's not succeeding. So Ralbag, in his very practical way, says, the way that the fool suffers, the anger of the fool causes him to suffer because it blinds him to the lessons he needs to learn. And Job, that's you. You're getting all angry about everything that's happening and therefore you're not thinking it through. Something must be changed in your life in order for you to have different results, Eliphaz says, albeit in metaphor. But that's the idea that he's trying to say. Not a metaphor, always. That's one approach.
We haven't seen him get angry.
Oh, we've seen Job angry already. You don't think chapter 3, I wish I'd never been born, cursing the stars? That qualifies as angry. Not angry at God. We haven't seen that yet. It's coming. But we've seen him. We've seen him angry, yes. Rashi takes a different tack, because Rashi in general, as we're going to see, has a whole different approach to Eliphaz. Whereas the main approach we've been taking is that Eliphaz's rebuke is really not a moral rebuke of you're a bad person doing bad things. It's more, you're going off in the wrong direction, Job. You're blaming the wrong parties, right? That's the way he's been looking at it. Rashi's take in general in this section is that this is moral rebuke, and so the fool who gets angry is killing himself, as we saw in sentence 2, in the sense that his anger itself is unrighteous, and therefore makes it less likely that God is going to help him. Not his anger is self-defeating practically, like Ralbag wants to say, but his anger is morally wrong, is the way Rashi looks at it. Two different approaches there. Rita.
I just want to make a comment about anger. It depends on what the anger and how you deal with it.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, we see this in history, you know, Martin Luther King, you know, his people, they were very angry about the prejudice. So, they did something, this injustice, they did something very positive, and they made changes. So that's another way of just responding to the anger, or looking at what is under the anger, is the spirit of helplessness.
Point taken.
Or stuff like that. So,
yeah.
You know, this whole idea of anger is not always a negative thing. It depends how you feel.
Right, right. But we could look at Eliphaz on different levels, right? One way to read Eliphaz in general is that he's a little obtuse. He doesn't quite get what's going on. Another way to look at it is, he feels this is the appropriate message for Job right now, and that's why he articulates it this way. We don't know, and we don't have enough background to be able to say, just like we don't know if his vision is a real vision or just something he made up. We don't actually know. But he continued here, as we saw, to say, I've seen fools strike roots, develop success, and then everything collapses around them. And we saw whether he's cursing or not cursing, that is a side note. But he says, even the person's children will suffer. And Mitzudat David comments on it, explaining that children will suffer because no one's going to have mercy on them. Because no one likes someone who is angry. People don't like being around anger. As a general rule, leaving nuances aside. People don't like being around anger. And therefore, he's going to alienate all of his friends. Which is, I think, a little bit of a warning to Job. With your anger, you are going to alienate your friends, those of us who actually showed up. And therefore, the fool loses, not only for himself, but for his kids, because he doesn't have friends of the parents anymore to help them. In Job's case, that's irrelevant. The kids are gone. But that's not neither here nor there. The point is that he's trying to say that anger also alienates. And he says, this brings us to that last sentence that we read. He said, man is born to struggle. Struggle doesn't come from the agents elsewhere that are responsible for it. Man generates it. It's a natural thing. It's a natural part of his life. And if you take a look at source number 4, you see Malbim's take on it. He writes, Ha'adam nolad la'mol bi'igya kapav. Man is born to strain with his hands. Uva'amalo yavi lachmo. Through his work, through his struggle, he's going to bring his bread. He says, I have news for you. If someone finds wealth without having to work for it, who amal va'aven? That in the end will be struggle and corruption. It will not grow, it will not endure in the hands of his children. Get rich quick doesn't work. We find that throughout Tanakh. There are many instances of this. And that's the way that Malbim understands his last point is, that's part of life. And that's why the fool doesn't succeed in passing things along to his children. Now again, I had said to you that that last clause in the Hebrew is a really hard clause. I rendered it as flames fly up, so too man is born to struggle. And that I think is a fair translation of it. Other translations take B'nai Reshef to be some kind of demonic force or birds. With the idea still being the same. As they fly, so too the human beings struggle. What does the art scroll have there? Spiritual beings. Ha! That's the way around the demonic problem. Call them spiritual. They're of spirits, right? They're spirits. Okay. That's an interesting approach to it. But take a look at source number 5. because I thought this was also, this was a really, really good insight. As you can see from the title of the piece that I'm quoting, the writer, John Burnite, sees this last line here of this section as a response to Job's curse that he gave back in chapter 3 of the day he was born. He says, in effect, Eliphaz is saying that Job, in seeking to eradicate the day of his birth with gloom, is speaking as one who venerates Resheth. And what he's talking about is that there was an ancient Near Eastern underworld deity known as Resheth. And so what he's saying is that Job, in his declarations of the day of his birth should become dark, right, like we read, so you're like somebody who worships Resheth. You are like B'nai Resheth. So he says, given this deity's association with pestilence, the deity being Resheth, his wording may also serve as an oblique reference to Job's diseased condition, the shchin, the boils that he has. Job 5:7 might then be translated, man is born for trouble, and sons of Resheth, yagbihu uf, yagbihu lahagbia, to raise up, we took it as flight, they exalt uf, not meaning to fly, but gloom. And he shows that you could use the ayin pei there. You could associate that with darkness as well. So what he's saying is, man is born for trouble and sons of Resheth exalt gloom. Your response to your trouble has been like these worshippers of Resheth. Instead of responding in a healthy way and turning to God, you're instead saying, I wish gloom would take everything. Eliphaz goes on in 5:8 to contrast himself with Job, asserting that if he were in Job's place, he would turn to God rather than invoke the forces of darkness. Yes?
He talks about, I wish I wasn't born. But is there anywhere that he says, I wish I could
make money?
There's no
mention of
suicide.
Yep. Isn't that a fascinating thing?
Yes, because I would have been sure. That, well, okay, God's not, I'm sorry I'm bored, I'm in this pain, I don't know if they have an easy way of suicide, I'm going to just kill myself and that'll be over.
I don't have an answer for this, I don't have an answer for this question. I've been wondering about this question since the beginning of the book. Why doesn't he, is it really just that it was beyond thinkable? I don't think that's true. Historically, I don't think that's true. But the way this book is written, you have somebody who consistently says, and he will keep on saying, that he wants to leave this world, and not a hint that he's willing to do anything about it.
Yeah, maybe he wasn't brave enough to do it.
I don't know. We just have no hint, no mention, no discussion.
Well,
I don't know.
Unthinkable.
That's the question. I mean, we find it in Tanakh in a case in which somebody does it in order to avoid great pain. Or mockery, whatever it was, when King Saul has himself killed and ultimately falls on his sword when captured by the Philistines. But that's not what we're talking about here. Suicide as escape from life. I don't know what to do with that. I'm sure it's been written on. I just haven't seen it yet.
You're looking for meaning, though. I mean, when you don't necessarily want to commit suicide. You want to validate your experience and have a greater meaning.
Right. So that's an interesting question. The question that she asks essentially is Job serious? Meaning in chapter 3, when he said, I wish I were gone, I wish I'd never been born, and the night that I was conceived should be cursed, and everything that he said there, you know, maybe it doesn't mean he literally wanted out of this world. Maybe he's looking for meaning and expressing his frustration and anger. Hold the thought, please, because I think Eliphaz is with you. Whether he's right or not, I'm not sure. But I think I want to come back to that when we finish chapter 5.
I don't think he doesn't want to kill himself, really, because that's going
to make God more. Well, he doesn't mind that. He doesn't mind getting God angry.
No, but I think he
might kind of should. So does Job believe that there's anything after this world? We have to come back to that when we get to some verses that relate to it. Let's go a little further here, though, because we have so much to see. What we see now, today, is that closing section in chapter 4, where Eliphaz presents his vision and says, man is feeble and frail and relatively unrighteous. That's his vision. And he says that you're only hurting yourself with your outrage. Accept that suffering is natural. And now he's going to tell him what he should do. chapter 5, sentences 8 to 16, page 1626. He says, God is wonderful. God gives out lollipops. Ulam, but he says, Ani Edrosh El Kale. I am going to seek out God. He asked me, I would be praying if I were you, Job. He's on a real winning streak with his, you know, with his advice here. It's comforting. I would turn my words towards God. Once again, that poetry, the Edrosh and Asim Divrati. Right, a passage that is familiar, resonates from liturgy and Tanakh. The God does great things beyond what anyone can imagine. Niflaot, wonders, ad ein mispar, infinite in number. Hanotein matar al pnei haaretz, and now he talks about the gifts that God gives. He says in sentences 10 and 11, Hanotein matar al pnei haaretz, he gives rain upon the land. Vishaleach mayim al pnei chutzot, he sends water over the outlying areas. I want to talk about that a little bit, but finish the section first. Lasum shefalim lemarom. He takes those who had been low and he elevates them to the heavens, which either refers to people or to the plants that grow from the rain. Vikodrim sagvu yesha. And the kodrim. Kodrim is usually a term for someone who is in mourning and someone who is lowly. Much like kedera is a pot, is like being dark, like the pot, someone of dark countenance because he is depressed and upset is what we're talking about. So, excuse me, the kodrim is sagvu yesha. He brings this great salvation and rescue for those who were holech koder, those who had been suffering and who were gloomy or in mourning, or to, again, the plants that had been buried in the ground. He elevates. And now, after in 10 and 11, he told us about God's gifts, in 12 to 16, he talks about God as being just. Mefer machshavot arumim. He ruins the counsel of those who are clever. Velota asena yideim tushia, their hands cannot execute a plan. Loched chachamim beormam, he traps those who are clever in their cunning, in their cleverness. Vatsat niftalim nimhara, and the counsel of those who would cheat others. The word niftal requires its own class, but we don't have time for it. But the counsel of those who try to trick people, nimhara, is hasty, and therefore it collapses. Yomam yifag shuchoshech, those people who try to cheat others, in the day they will encounter darkness. Frankly, Job had wanted darkness, but in the day they'll encounter darkness. V'chalayla yimashishu batzaharayim, like night, they're going to feel their way in the middle of the day. He rescues, God rescues from the sword, from their mouths, meaning those they wanted to chop up and eat, so to speak. And from the strong, he rescues the avyon, the indigent. Vatehi ladal tikva, there is hope for the needy. Va'ola takav tzapiha, we pointed out last week, another one that makes it into the Rosh Hashanah davening. And iniquity will have its mouth closed up. God is wonderful. God does great things. Interesting, Dad Mikra, Amos Chacham, is willing to give Eliphaz a lot of credit. He says, you notice that Eliphaz doesn't say, you should pray. In your position, I would pray. If I were you, if I were in this circumstance, he isn't direct. Okay, fine. The line about sending the rain on the land and on the outlying areas, so this is a little bit separate from Eov, but I couldn't skip it. It caught the attention of the sages, because what do you mean, land and outlying areas? And what they suggested is what I brought you in source number 6. You can see it for yourself. I'm not going to read it aloud. But they suggest that the land is the land, meaning Israel. And everything else is outlying. God is notain. He gives the rain to Israel. And then he's sholeach. He sends out rain with emissaries. They'll take care of everybody else. Israel is God's focus, as we are told in Deuteronomy, that that's the land that God watches. In any case, Malbim has another explanation. The land is where you receive rain from rain directly. Then there are outlying areas that get from the rivers, where the rivers are rained on from elsewhere, and then the rain flows down through the river to get there. That's the idea when rain is in the outlying area. It's not it doesn't change anything fundamentally in terms of understanding his vision. His point is to say God gives, and God is just, and he's clever in his justice. Notice that he said, in sentence 13, that God is locheid chachamim be'ormam. He catches the clever in their own traps. So Malbim in source number 7 says, it's one thing to foil somebody's plot. It's another thing to turn the plot around so that they will succeed in what they tried to accomplish, and their success will be their worst nightmare. He catches them with their plot. And the example that Malbim uses is, of course, the brothers of Joseph. They succeeded. They got him sold down to Egypt as a slave. And look where it led them. They, you get the opposite of that which you anticipated. And so his conclusion here is to say, God protects people from harm, Job. And that's going to bring us to the end of the chapter. Watch what he does here. Hine, sentence 17. Hine ashrei enosh yochichenu eloka. Fortunate is the man whom God rebukes. Umusar shakai al timas. Don't reject what you're getting from God here. Don't reject the rebuke and the suffering. It's good for you, Job. Oh boy. So I wonder he doesn't slug him, you know. You don't need a chapter to respond. Ki hu yachiv v'yachbash. He causes pain, but he also heals. Yimchatz, he strikes via dav tirpena, but his hands will also heal. Right? Machatz divani erpa, language from the Torah at the end of Deuteronomy. And then he turns directly to Job. All the language here, if you're a Hebrew reader, you'll appreciate this. From sentence 19 through 26 is all second person. He has stopped talking about things in the abstract. He says, B'sheish tsarot yatzi leka. In six troubles, he will save you. And in the seventh, bad will not hit you. And now he enumerates the seven. Yes, we're coming to that. Hold the thought, you are 100% right. He's going to enumerate the seven now. Bira'av, in famine, padcha mimavet, he saves you from death. Uvamilchama, and in war, number two, midei charev, he saves you from the sword. Bishot lashon, when the tongue goes forth, techavei, you will be able to hide. There are several different explanations there, whether that means slander or being cursed, or it means the attack of a nation that has another language. Or Rashi takes it as the Satan, for those who wanted the Satan earlier, now you got him. Rashi takes it as the Satan who used his tongue against Job. When the tongue goes forth, you will be able to hide. That's number three. V'lo tira mishod ki yavo. And you will not be afraid of destruction when it comes. Shod here meaning destruction brought by bandits who attack you. As opposed to l'shod u'l'chafan tischak, you will laugh. At Shod and Kafan, Shod here, according to Amos Chacham, is a reference to plague, based on a verse in Tehillim that it's linked to, Tehillim 91. And Kafan, we know, is a form of Ra'av, a form of hunger, but evidently different from the Ra'av he had before. There are two different kinds of Ra'av. There's a Ra'av in which nothing grows, and then there's a Ra'av in which you don't have access to the food. And finally, umechayat ha'aretz al tira, you will not need to fear the wild animals. So in these seven types of suffering, you will be protected. Ki im avnei ha'sadeh britecha, v'chayat ha'sadeh hashlamalach. He says, your covenant will be with the rocks of the field, meaning they'll be your ally. The world around you will be your ally. The chayat ha'sadeh hashlemah lach, the beasts of the field will be at peace with you. The yadata, sentence 24, I know I am running. But I want to make sure that we get to the end of the chapter today, because really, Eliphaz getting 2 weeks is plenty. The yadata ki shalom alecha, you will know, you will be confident that your tent will be at peace. Ufak adatana v'chav lo sechta, you will be able to visit your home and not sin, meaning there will be no sin in your household. V'yadata ki rav zarecha, you will know that your seed are many. V'tzatzaecha ke'eseh ba'aretz, he's painting this wonderful picture. Your descendants will be like the grass of the field. Tavo be'kelach elei kaver, you will come to kelach, in kelach, to the grave. Kelach is a hard word. As noted by the commentators here, this word only appears twice in Tanakh, both in Job And the commentators take it, as Rabat does, that it means the end of your days. There's a writer, Alon Pinker, who wrote an article in a work called The Bible Translator in volume 65, in which he says, Kelach is Kala Leach, when the moisture is done. Meaning at the end of your life, once the moisture of the body is done, then he says that you'll come to the grave, meaning at the proper time. Ka'alot Gadish Bi'ito, just like the haystack is built up and collected and harvested at the proper time. Hine zos chakarnua kenhi. He says, I've examined all this. This is the way it is, Job. Shma'ena ve'ata dalach. Listen to it and know it. That's what he said. There is so much to say here. A couple of quick points. Number one, the 6 and 7. Right, which I saw that Dora and Arela had caught on to over there. So I gave you references here, source number 8. You're going to look at them at some point, please, but not right now. We find 7 as a number of punishment all over Tanakh. The first reference I gave you there, Shivatayim Yukam Kayin, the person who kills Cain, will be punished sevenfold. Then, the curses that are given indeed to the Jews at the end of the book of Vayikra of Leviticus, where Hashem says, if you persevere in your wickedness, I will bring you punishment sevenfold for your sins. And then enumerate 7 penalties, 7 punishments. And then in Daniel also, we are told that the Jews, having sinned in the first temple, they're going to have 7 and sevenfold punishments. Those who were here for Daniel may recall that the 7 is a theme in the book of Daniel in general, but 7 is associated with their punishments as well. So it's not just in Job that we find this 7 with punishments. Sorry? 7 is a big number in Tanakh in general. But yes, you also have 7 bad years there, although that doesn't come true. They only have 2 years of famine. They don't actually get 7 years of famine. It stops when Jacob comes down. So he says, this is the truth, Job. I've investigated it. I've seen it. Which to me is very funny. Because didn't he say before that this was given to him in a vision? Make up your mind. Is this a vision, or is this your own ideas that you're now presenting, Eliphaz? That's one reason why I'm not sure whether the vision is just his device, as opposed to something that he's saying actually happened. So to sum up, Eliphaz, we're not going to get to see the sources at the bottom yet. I will come back to them next week, God willing. But just to make sure that we understand what we've seen here, 3 basic themes. Number one, as we saw last week, suffering happens for a reason, such as divine rebuke, perhaps. Number two, you're foolish if you express outrage over what has happened. It doesn't help you. Number three, there's hope if you turn to God. All right, there's more we have to do with this. I think I'm going to call it here. Next week, we will finish off Eliphaz, and then we'll get to see how Job responds. What I really wanted to hear was how you think Job is going to answer this, besides with a fist to the mouth. What do you think Job is going to say after all of this? To be continued. Thank you.